Hi, you're listening to Talking About Organizations, a podcast about management and organization studies, where we read and discuss foundational texts and key ideas that inform the way we think about organized work today. Talking About Organizations is a community resource supported by our listeners. To find out how and learn more about the program, visit our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. We also thank the Management Learning Journal and the European Group for Organizational Studies for their wonderful support. Now on with the show.
Welcome to episode 91, where we are continuing our discussion of the works of Mary Parker Follett from the compilation Dynamic Administration, first published in 1942. This is part one of the episode where we will discuss four chapters from the compilation to supplement our previous episode, number 5, on Follett's The Giving of Orders. To learn more about the text, please go to our website at www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Hi, this is Tom calling from Carlisle, Pennsylvania in the United States.
Hello, this is Friedrich Wegener calling from Mettmann in Germany.
Hi, this is Anna calling from Gothenburg, Sweden.
And I want to quickly introduce Anna. Anna is a dear, dear colleague of mine. My interests, of course, are pragmatism, organizing, and design. And she has the same box, so to say. So as one of the fellow pragmatists that I know in these fields, I'm really excited to actually have Anna here today as one of the experts that I know on Follett. And I thought it would be very appropriate to have Anna join our discussion of these wonderful chapters of Follett's work.
Yeah, why don't you go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself, Anna?
Well, thank you for inviting me and thank you for that introduction. Nice introduction, Fritjof. Like you said, I'm a scholar of pragmatist philosophers, and Follett, perhaps in particular for the last few years, has been an interest of mine because I do research on what's sometimes called new ways of working or self-managing organizations. And I find Follett a particularly fruitful philosopher, I should say, working out the practical implications of our philosophy for organizations. So I guess that's why I'm here today.
Yeah, thank you very much. And it's interesting for us because we don't typically go back and do another episode on a figure that we have previously covered. But, you know, given how much we've done now, this is now episode 91, we've covered quite a lot of people. But some of our earliest episodes, you know, focused on perhaps a particular chapter or a particular part of a work. And in some ways, like with episode 5, when we did Mary Parker Follett the first time, it was largely focused as a contrast to the episodes done previously on scientific management. So it was a comparison contrast. And at the time, Follett was perhaps a bit less known, less understood, less covered. That's for sure. And then here we are 6.5 years later, and we realize that, you know, that episode covered just one chapter, just one paper or one speech of Follett's. And there's so much in some of the adjacent chapters, particularly the early ones where the giving of orders, the chapter that was covered, you can look at it, you know, we covered it in isolation, but the rest of it, the first four chapters, are really kind of a whole. And so we thought, given everything that's happened in the past few years, given a lot of renewed interest in pragmatism, in Follett herself, and in other related works, and also given that we have recently covered Louis Brandeis, which covers the professionalization of business, which also happens to be in this same work as chapter 5 and some of the later chapters, we thought this would be a good time to go back and revisit that work. So here we are. I just want to, just for our listeners' benefit, just to kind of talk about the first four chapters, you know, or at least give the titles of it, and then hand it over and say, you know, what do we make of these? Because the giving of orders was actually chapter 2, and the focus that the previous episode had was specifically the law of the situation, which is a very, very fascinating and a central idea. But chapter 1 is titled Constructive Conflict. Chapter 3 was Business as an Integrative Unity. Chapter 4 was called simply Power. And these all coalesce under a particular idea that Follett had about the importance of integration as a as opposed to compromise or other forms of conflict resolution. So why don't you give us a rundown of what she was trying to say.
Okay, let me start by saying I was very glad to see that you chose these chapters also in collection, because I think they really lay out her foundational ideas. And especially the first chapter about constructive conflict says so much about her basic philosophy. I think just a combination of constructive conflict, to see conflict as something that is creative, that is a force for change, that's something positive, perhaps, as much as it can be negative, I think was quite, well, at least for her time, it was quite, I shouldn't perhaps say revolutionary, but it was something that was quite different from the dominant idea, which she calls conflict as a fight, as a fighting attitude, which is very clear in, for example, Taylor, the Scientific Principles of Management, where it is a lot about avoiding. And I think the background to that is at the time they had all these, what was often referred to as a war between unions and employers, workers and employers. And it's about, you know, taking sides and trying to get as much as possible in some kind of bargaining process. And so Follett was saying, no, that's not the way to look at it. We shouldn't look at conflict as a fight, but we should look at that as an opportunity to integrate our differences.
Should we maybe just kind of like round that off? Like what's the big idea behind all four chapters?
I think maybe actually can be a good idea, don't you think, Fritjof, to use the notion of integration as a way of explaining her? Or should I go, the other way around, I could start by saying, you know, what the big idea is. Actually, maybe you're right. The big idea is about her process philosophy and a sort of relational thing. That's what you're after, right? Okay.
But maybe I'll just pick up where Anna kind of stopped and I bring that point in, okay? And thank you a lot, Anna, because I think also if you look at the first four chapters, it's maybe not always obvious, but if you kind of like read through it, also looking at the work of other pragmatists, but also kind of like where we are right now, it becomes really important that this integrative aspect that's really important throughout all four chapters also brings forth the relational and the processional nature of a lot of her thinking. Because it's never static, it's always kind of like moving forward. That's also why her approach is so progressive. And I think what always strikes me in reading Follett, and especially this, because it's so much on administration, so much on organizing, it's this dynamic nature. I think that really comes out quite clearly in these chapters. At the same time, she talks very profoundly about a lot of topics, and sometimes it's not even as apparent how profound it actually is. But I feel like these things, they come out in all four of the first chapters. But I think it's also kind of like picked up in the last chapter, but in a quite a different way, because then it kind of comes back more to the scientific method, what it means to base a profession on science.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I think also what is interesting, in her previous book, she goes a little bit more into her philosophy, perhaps, and the underlying principles. And here she's a little bit more practical because she talks directly to businessmen, which makes it easier for us. But she's also quite explicit in some places in this text that to her, it's really about applying a philosophy and making it practical. That is actually what she's trying to do when she's working out all these principles and the methods that she's talking about. And that philosophy is also, as she mentions, it's based on viewing all these issues that she's talking about here, like authority and power, as human issues or psychological issues, as she says. It's not what she's after, is not the structures per se, it is what you're doing about them. Her focus is rather on the activities, and it's not about people as a specific role, for example, the role of the manager, it's the relations between people. So it's the concrete activities that they do, which are of her interest, which is a quite significant shift in perspective for many others at the time she was writing.
Now, I'm coming at this from somewhat of a different perspective, because I'm not a pragmatism scholar. So when she's discussing, for example, the topics of conflict, the topics of power, of integration, and also what she describes as the law of the situation, I'm seeing a lot of parallels in other scholarly works that have come since. It was very fascinating to me to see these same issues that were, you know, that are interpreted, like, for example, the negotiations literature, a whole topic that's associated with trying to get away from bargaining over positions and instead bargaining over interests. And it was interesting to see that this has its roots, or at least is in parallel with what she was thinking about almost a full century earlier, and the way that she describes what conflict is. And I agree that it's interesting to see how through the whole four chapters, in order to understand the practical nature of what we do with these different types of negotiations, or understand the constructive form of conflict, that it all really melds well together.
And I think maybe it might be good to just kind of try to quickly reiterate Follett's perspective on conflict and kind of like the different methods for dealing with conflicts in her own words. So she differentiates between domination, compromise, and integration. And integration obviously is the one that we're talking about now most so far. But domination, in her own words, is victory of one side over the other, which of course is a common way to deal with conflict, but usually it's something that is more, as she also says, easiest for the moment, but not usually successful in the long run. The second one is compromise. So it's the way we settle most of our controversies. Each side gives up a little in order to have peace, or, to speak more accurately, in order that the activity which has been interrupted by the conflict may go on. So that's her perspective on compromise. And then the last one, the integration, is when two desires are integrated, that means that a solution has been found in which both desires have found a place, that neither side has had to sacrifice anything. I think that's really interesting, where kind of like it's not where either side is gaining something and losing something, but kind of like finding the creative way out, kind of like the third way of dealing with the situation by creating this kind of win-win situation, the term that Bollett also coined. But that's really an integral part of her thinking here, that this kind of integration is possible also in business, but it requires different kinds of relationships.
Right. And this is where the discussion about negotiation over positions versus over interests is a good parallel, because it's that difference between compromise and integration mirrors that very closely. I'll also say that she also, although she didn't actually explicitly say so, she did present a fourth option in here, which has come to be known as stalemate, which is essentially, if you do not succeed in domination, then you end up with essentially both sides just sort of muddling along without an actual solution. And she alluded to that a couple of pages later. So all of these potential outcomes of conflict, and it was very clear from her mind, you know, similar to negotiations literature nowadays, that integration, the win-win situation, is the one preferred. But then I also, you know, think it's interesting to see, you know, on the one hand, she's promoting it, but she's also acknowledging the various barriers to that, not just this chapter, but also kind of later, of what gets in the way of integration, which includes the desire for domination.
Yeah, I think also actually one other way of looking at it is that it's two rather than four alternatives, in a sense, because domination, compromise, or stalemate are just variants of this attitude. So there are two different attitudes, the fight attitude, which have two sides, the fight sides, as she puts it. And if you are in that game, so to speak, you just keep the discussion into these kind of two mutually exclusive fields back and forth. And so you really never progress. You really never get anywhere. The difference with integration is that there you introduce change. So something happened. It requires invention, but it also requires for the people involved to change. It's a revaluation of the situation of such. So you have to take a different attitude. And this, I think, is a key word more than she talks a lot about methods. But, you know, what she really means oftentimes is attitude. So you have to look at yourself in a different way and the people around you in a different way and take a step back and see, okay, what is it that this is really about? What are our real desires and how can we work a way around this so that we can all get what we want, but through a novel thought and a novel solution. And when you come out of that process, the whole thing has changed and you yourself has changed because the values have changed. So there's a revaluation, in a sense, of yourself and of the group. So that's a fundamentally different logic that she wants to introduce.
And I think the beautiful thing is that in the next chapter, or at least the one that we read next, as Business as an Integrative Unity, I think we see a lot of this actually sort of say work out. So where she highlights that it's much more about integrating the different departments and the different interests, but also the different perspectives, but kind of like find a way to integrate these instead of having, so to say, the destructive conflict, finding the compromise, having the departmental policy less important than the general policy of the company, but really much more integrative and kind of like use the different perspectives that every department has to kind of like come up with better solutions. And I feel like it's really a wonderful way how she applies these ideas, especially from the first chapter, also in this third chapter.
You're referring to this, I think, to the section that starts on page 48, which is the conferring versus fighting, which is, specifically to present the alternative to the ordinary fight orientation that that people are accustomed to, or were accustomed to, that she's trying to get us away from. And she gives a lot of good practical examples. I highlighted a whole bunch of phrases in here where she's talking about industries or situations where you have a works council or you have a union. And it isn't so much that one method is preferred over the other. It is that it produces outcomes or it produces options by conferring that just seems so obvious if people could put down their gloves or put down their fists and not fight. Amusing the way that she writes it, because she makes it sound so like, if we could just step back and put the set aside the emotions or set aside our guards, the solution would seem to be obvious. I'm sure that in the actual situations where she's writing from, it's not as easy as maybe she makes it sound in this distilled speech. But I'll just read one passage from page 50, which I really liked. One man said to me, when I worked in a shoe shop, the men were talking all the time of compromise, but here we are shown what we really earn. Others spoke of their objection to the works councils making requests on the compromise basis. Let them ask, I heard said, for what they really think right, and then the managers will think them reasonable. This is interesting, I think. So in a way, this isn't necessarily her pushing for this conferring either. This is an example of where she's presenting situations where the opportunity to confer is already there among the people that she's working with or she's observing. And so there's a desire for conferring and not fighting. And then the question is, how do you translate that into real no kidding action, which can be challenging?
And that's why there's all the way in the beginning of the chapter, it's a bit of a longer quote, but I think it's a really good one to kind of better understand what she means with this integrative unity. So she writes here is that it seems to me that the first test of business administration of industrial organization should be whether you have a business with all its parts so coordinated, so moving together in their closely knit and adjusting activities, so linking, interlocking, interrelating, that they make a working unit. That is, not a congeries of separate pieces, but what I have called a functional whole or integrative unity. And I find this kind of thinking, it seems to me so radical and at the same time so difficult to actually have in practice. But I found it really interesting because there's a certain kind of wholeness to this approach, almost like a systemic approach again, that I think it's really interesting to kind of like explore further.
Yeah, I think that's a critical sort of thing to understand what she really means by this functional unity, which I think to her is a philosophical point. And this is what I meant with it's kind of about practically working out her philosophical ideas. So she says here, it is impossible, however, to work most effectively at coordination until you have made up your mind where you stand philosophically in regard to the relation of parts to the whole. So, you know, if you think of relation of parts to the whole as a stationary whole, you know, then the Taylor system, as she calls it, you know, looking at things as separate pieces, that works out perfectly fine. But if you think of your organization as a whole in the making, then it's a completely different deal. If you think of your organization that is something dynamically moving, that is all constantly in progress with the different departments and the different people relating to each other and being dependent on each other, then you're thinking about your organization as a whole in the making. And that leads to radically different implications for how it should be managed. And I think this captures the sort of the essence of her philosophical point.
Yeah, later on in the chapter too, it's that it is also apparent how much she's, you know, she's using these examples to point out the various different barriers. And it's not even necessarily about interpersonal relationship. It's also about structural relationships. And another passage that I had, I'd start this one because it was, it just seems a natural way for a negotiation to take place. In the factory just spoken of, where the lineup in conference, it was said, was not always of managers on one side and workmen on the other, I heard few complaints of the management. But I found, on the other hand, that the representatives of the workmen were very wary about going back to their constituents and praising the managers. This is another example where there's, even though you may have desires, may even have activities that try to pursue this integrative whole, there's still structural differences. There's still power distance. There's still a certain ways in which this fight mentality or this us versus them still kind of comes in and limits the interactions that people have with the situation or causes people to become cautious. And that's when we're trying to make this more practical, put this into use, we have to think not just of the relations in the macro sense that have to be addressed, but also some of these little things, the micro interactions that that also can get in the way.
Yeah, I think this is also what she's alluding to many times, those micro interactions, when she's also talking about, let's not sort of theorize things and talk about them in the abstract, because that's when, and she talks about this already when she talks about conflict in the first chapter. So how do you avoid this kind of fight attitude? And how do you reach integration? Well, basically get down to action, right? Because when you talk about these fluffy words, then it's a way of evading conflict because nobody really understands what the other says. It doesn't really come home to you. Whereas you start to get down in your local situation and talk to each other about the facts of the case or the very specifics, then you start to understand each other and then conflict dissipates or it becomes easier to handle. You can much easier come up with an integrative solution. So in this sense, it's very much about the personal relations in this really micro perspective. That's the key.
And I think one example is where Follett highlights that the planning of work or the managing of work and the work itself cannot be separated. So what she writes here, she writes they, but she means workers like miners or builders or whatever. They must exercise considerable discretion in their work because unless they do, the work does not get done. And no amount of supervision can compensate for the absence of discretion. So what she's highlighting here is that even the sort of say the lowest worker still has to do some kind of managing, has to have some kind of say in how the work needs to get done. But she also highlights the other way around. The same also applies for the manager. And by breaking down this distinction between planning and execution, the way that, for example, a tailor is still highlighted, she highlights that actually the managers and the workers, they actually are more similar than they might see at first. And that there's also a chance here at deeper and at better integration than one might have seen before.
And this all sounds to me, you know, like a perfect lead into the discussion she gives later on collective responsibility. You know, it's the subsequent section. Apparently, she had gotten some criticism on this because she includes in page 55 a statement that I am often misunderstood on this point of collective responsibility. People sometimes think when I emphasize it, that I do not believe in decentralization. I know no one who believes more strongly in decentralization than I do. So you're right, absolutely right, Fridtjof. She's really showing, you know, that there's the workers and the managers have, as sets of individuals within the setting, they have responsibilities to each other, both to enable the work of the other. And this sense of collective responsibility is more or less a feeling, or an orientation that enables, or that makes that possible. It's kind of how I interpreted it.
What's nice, so she quotes her work, previous work on creative experience to kind of like highlight this a bit more. Because I think one thing to understand is that experience and pragmatism has a different and I think somewhat richer meaning, and it's quite central to pragmatism, and it's also quite central to the work of Follett. So what she writes here is that our aim in the so-called democratic organization of industry should be not to give workmen a vote on things they know nothing about, but so to organize the plan that the workmen's experience can be added to that of the experts. We must see just where their experience will be a plus matter, and we must plan to have the workmen learn more and more of the industry as a whole. To think that a man can come from his particular machine and vote intelligently on the running of the business is exactly the mistake we have made in politics. And I think that's a very, very interesting point that also resonates with a lot of discussions now around politics and how to involve citizens. But I think this kind of idea that how can we organize the plan so that the workman's experience can be added to that of the expert? I think that's a very, very interesting, very, very deep thought, but it's also very challenging to actually do.
Yeah, and I think this comes to, again, the core of what she wants to say, also with the notion of collective responsibility, which is that you have to take responsibility not only for your own part, right, your own group or team, first of all, obviously, not only for yourself and your task, but for your group, but then also for the organization as a whole. So it is kind of dual perspective and dual responsibility, which is the central for her idea of organizing. And they shouldn't be in opposition to each other, of course, as the fight attitude, but rather as an integrative attitude. So it's you come to look at the whole from the perspective of your department or your unit. So how can this difference become a resource that rather than seen as, you know, different sides with or opposite sides? Did that make sense at all?
Yeah, because it's interesting because, you know, sometimes when we think about, you know, workers and management, we think of the divide being between the, you know, that there's this dividing line between what is down at the front line versus what is higher. She, in the later, we're still in the same chapter, now we're getting towards the end of it, specifically highlights the administrator as having a separate role, which is interesting because, and by the way, I'm still fresh in my mind is the recording we did. This is episode 90 on James Thompson's Social Science Basis of Administrative Theory. Eerie how the two ideas sound almost identical, because Thompson is the one who introduced the thought that the basic function of administration was co-alignment, which is to ensure that the co-alignment between the individual and the collective, such that the collective is capable of enabling the work of the individual, and everything that the individual does enables the collective. We may be redrawing the boundary between the individual and the collective here is perhaps between workers and managers, because that was part of Follett's world at the time. But it's still kind of the same thing, the sense of her saying that the administrator, which would be at the highest level of the organization, is there to ensure some sort of integration between the interests or co-alignment of those interests, and to try to keep the dividing line between the two away and allow for this collective responsibility to happen. Whereas sometimes we would think of administration as the management extended and would not see it as a third party.
And I think one of the things that comes also clear here is, you know, as design scholars, Anna and I, of course, are very interested in notions like problems and solutions and how do we get from problems to solutions. And so there's two interesting sentences that I would like to highlight. So first is, there really is not such a thing, strictly speaking, as a departmental problem. There's hardly a problem, moreover, which can be considered purely one of production or distribution. So I think in this sentence already it becomes clear there's kind of like this relational nature of all problems. You can't just say it's only the problem of this department.
Well, she clearly says that the crux of business administration is the relations between departments, between functions. So it's really clear about being what her focus is. It's all about the relations because they are all... Yeah,
but she,
go ahead.
Yeah, and she draws out a deeper relation that, as someone who studied design, is interested in design, is very, very interesting. Namely, she talks about, in fact, one of the things I feel most strongly about business administration as it exists today is that until we find some better way of uniting technical and so-called psychological problems than we have at present, we are far from efficient business administration. And I think this challenge, maybe now we might call it not just psychological, but also social, but kind of like the link between the technical and the social, and how I think very, very few people are really proficient in both areas, but that a lot of problems actually kind of like reach into both areas. I think it's a really profound statement that's also very difficult to really engage with.
Well, I was interpreting that the use of psychological in that case is one of climate, so the workplace climate. That is the acceptance or the comfort or the satisfaction. I mean, many different ways of thinking about climate, but just the way that workers feel about being part of the organization and also managers. I don't think that, you know, I think in the way that she's presenting this, is it's not just about the workers having psychological issues. It's also the climate that extended across the entire organization. Because in a way, the fighting orientation is itself a climate problem. And the extent to which that it gets in the way of one's ability to perform one's role within the organization, whether that's worker or management, is significant enough. I think it's fair enough that she was looking at uniting technical and so-called climate problems, because indeed they do interact. And we've had episodes on other works from Tristan Bamforth, which we've cited numerous times. That episode was really great at showing how technical and climate, social fabric type issues are really closely integrated in organizations. You tear at one, you tear at the other one. And this is yet another example of where she is sort of presaging all of that kind of study that would come later.
I feel we kind of need to move towards power, but what's a good segue?
Let's just do power.
Because I think
Who needs a segue?
I can think of something.
Okay. Go ahead, Anna.
Okay. Well, I think when she talks about the psychological issues, it's also a very, very broad concept for her, which is more about, you know, human nature almost. So it covers like a very broad aspect of issues that has to do with humans and social factors and things that we would even call culture today. So it seems like it's very broad. And it seems to me that it's also about our perspective on organizations. And also, again, giving that she wrote this, you know, 100 years ago, and the focus was so much on what you call the technical issues. You know, everything was focused on the machine aspect, so to speak, of organizing, and she wanted to move towards the human aspects. And I think this is also clear in the chapter on power, which I find one of her more intriguing concepts. if we should call it that, because she presents a very different vision of power than was predominant at the time, when power was often related like this person has power. She calls that arbitrary power. And her definition is instead that power is a capacity. It's the ability to make things happen, to initiate change. And this is something that emerges again, of course, out of people's interactions, out of relations. So that's more of a complete shift in perspective, again, from looking at sort of individuals to looking at relations, to looking at activities rather than structures.
Yeah, the language of domination, the language of the fighting orientation, all of this just sort of leads to how she captures the power as understood and the power as she sees as being much more valuable. And she uses, the section starts on page 78, and it's power with versus power over. And power over clearly references the idea of individuals having power over other individuals. And using that, and the implication is using that power for individual desires or individual interests as opposed to collective interests. And so the domination that a manager would have over a worker is for the manager's good and not at all for the good of the worker. And there's, so the logic of how she derives it, the sense of power over, and therefore its alternative of power with, is very, very striking, and it's very, very consistent, which is obviously a good thing. But the power with is intriguing because this is a way of expressing the benefits of integration, that there is power from the integration that exceeds the power of individuals, what an individual can do for the organization independently. And she says explicitly, workmen should be led, not driven. And what she calls, what she refers to as led, would be a power with situation in which the manager is investing in the workman's ability to do the job, as opposed to being driven, which, you know, kind of connotes the idea of the manager is there with just basically some method of domination that makes the workmen do what they do for the manager's benefit or for the corporate's benefit without any benefit to the work.
I think there's, again, a nice quote where she kind of like suggests a test for this kind of power and what kind of power you are dealing with. So what she says is, if you want the best philosophical as well as the best psychological principle by which to test the legitimacy of power, by which you probably mean authority, you will ask whether it is integral to the process or outside the process. That is, whether, as we have said, it grows out of the actual circumstances, whether it is inherent in the situation. You cannot confer power because power is the blossoming of experience. I think this is, again, a really beautiful example of how the process philosophy of pragmatism and the centrality of experience really comes to the fore also with regards to process, to power, and testing and exploring and actually experience. What does it actually mean, so to say, to the word power? And when can we see power at work? And is this power actually integrated in the ongoing process, or does it remain outside of the process, thus unable to really learn from experience?
Yeah, and it's a very, very different way of looking at power than we, to a great extent, actually still do today, because the implication is, as she says, well, you can't delegate power because there's nothing to give, right? Power is not something, an entity that exists that we can distribute. But with her perspective, power emerges out of the social relations. So it's, as she put it, a self-developing capacity. So power, as she discusses also power, I mean, it's, we have a very vague conception of power. It can mean all things to all people, but, and it can be good or bad or whatever. But with her view, then power is, in this context, is something that you want to have more of rather than less, because you have it together and it's a capacity to act and change together. So there's no balance to be had between, again, like between, for example, workers and managers. You shouldn't aim for balance of power, but you should aim for joint development of power.
I think that's also why in the previous chapters, like, she highlights a lot that in dealing with a problem, in dealing with a situation, she especially in giving of orders and the wholeness of the situation, she highlights that it should really be collective undertaking of people together collectively trying to find the facts, trying to take the whole situation, but then kind of like find out what are the constituent parts and how are they relating to each other, and kind of like gain a better understanding through this collective process that as practical scholars we might call inquiry, thinking of the work of Pearson and Dewey. But I think these same ideas, they're also clearly in Follett's work. It's much more of a collective undertaking. And that actually might be an interesting link also to the last chapter that we read, namely this idea of how must business management develop in order to possess the essentials of a profession, and where she talks about that a profession is set to rest on the basis of a proved body of knowledge, and such knowledge is supposed to be used in the service of others rather than merely for one's own purposes. And so she highlights really much more kind of like a collective approach of how managers, business administrators could learn collectively about what methods work to deal with certain kind of problems. What are the results of applying these kind of problems, these kind of methods, and how could we learn together as a profession? But she also highlights that in order to really make that knowledge useful, it has to be systematized. It has to be, there have to be ways to really gain the knowledge and experience that someone else has made somewhere else, and try to find a way to bring that to bear on this situation. And I thought it was a really beautiful way to kind of like follow up on the previous chapters, to kind of like really think much more broadly about the profession of business administration.
Yeah, again, we did Brandeis about several episodes back, and it's a very, very similar type of a text. We're talking about experimentation. We're talking about doing all sorts of things, you know, to use scientific, you know, science or scientific methods to improve things and to better understand things and to relate to things, as opposed to leaving it to the emotions of the people involved in particular. And then she highlighted that it. And I think it's an important distinction. You know, it's a difference between depersonalization versus, say, dehumanization, which are too often easily conflated. The idea is to try to maintain this integration, to maintain this sense of collective responsibility. We can't let the emotions get in the way. We need to let rational thought, the scientific methods and things like that, to study, to experiment, to learn more as an approach. But the distinction between, like I said, depersonalization and dehumanization is that, you know, the tendency perhaps nowadays is to think of science as being very impersonal and not constructive in that particular way, not sort of ignoring or denigrating the subjective aspects of the problem. She's not talking about that at all. She's talking about, let's just set aside the emotions of the situation and let's let the methods be the guide to us understanding the situation, the problem we face, or whatever it is, and to move forward.
And what I found really interesting here is she again highlights that there's kind of like this technical side, and this time she calls it more the personnel side. So she writes that first, the scientific standard must be applied to the whole of business management. It is now often applied to only one part. Business management includes, on the technical side, it is usually called a knowledge of production and distribution, and two, on the personal side, a knowledge of how to deal fairly and fruitfully with one fellows. While the first has been recognized as a matter capable of being taught, the latter has often been thought to be a gift which some men possess and some do not. And I think this is a really important point, that we kind of like see that there's always the technical side to business. There's also this personnel side, but they shouldn't be separate. They should be kept integrative, and the links between the two should be seen. And I think this is actually at PROS in, I think, 2 years ago, this was actually highlighted, that a lot of stuff and studies of technology, they kind of like separate the making of the technology and the using of the technology, and we keep having these kind of splits. And I think she forcefully argues that actually it is both of them that are needed, and both of them also are needed if we want a more scientific approach to management.
Well, I also wanted to just highlight her use of the word science which is probably consistent with the use of the word at the time. You know, science in the progressive era was something very positive and you wanted to stick it to everything. And it's very easy to think about it the way we would think about scientific methods today, particularly perhaps in this community where she talks about it as you did, or as also, for example, Taylor did with his scientific principles, as something very, very broad. And her methods that she talks about is more something that we would perhaps call reflective practice or knowledge management or benchmarking or something like that. It's more about experimenting, documenting your experiments, documenting, seeing failure as a good thing, learning from it, and then sharing the learnings. Because she's also very clear about, oh, she doesn't mean it, you know, in the sense that it should be prescriptive or that it should be one way, one particular way, or that should be detailed. It should be something based on, you know, people's judgment for what works here. And it should be driven by the executives themselves, with the help of experts. So it's still, just to make the point that that's consistent with her theory of a functional unity or integration, that's always situated and it always departs from, well, the situation. So it's very difficult to think of something that would work that would be a lot, sort of a standardized method. Even though she talks about standards and methods, we need to think about them in sort of a malleable sense.
And that concludes the episode for today. Thank you for listening. The views expressed are those of the speakers and do not necessarily reflect those of their respective organizations or institutions. We hope that you enjoyed the conversation and found it valuable. And if so, please consider subscribing through your favorite podcast service and you won't miss an episode. We also welcome your feedback, so if you liked or didn't like something, or have a correction or suggestion for us, please get in touch via Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, or our website, www.talkingaboutorganizations.com. Again, thank you for listening, and we hope to see you for the conclusion of this episode here on Talking About Organizations.